back with episode 395 of The Critical Myth. I'm John, your host, and tonight we have...
Edmund from Greenville and Homeland. That's how you make effective use out of a pile of discarded medical equipment.
This is Gary, and I don't need any type of fancy necklaces. Trust me, you can keep them.
Yeah, and I have to say that I liked one of these shows better when it was a movie called Unforgettable. But I would say that, but I didn't really like the movie either. Okay, so let's see. We have a few things here to get caught up with. As we talked about last time, we are somewhat still dealing with a bit of a break for the holidays here in the States. So the deluge of shows coming back in January or premiering in January hasn't quite hit yet, but there's at least enough for us to get into a little bit more. But Edmund, I think you need to do something for the audience before we do actually start to delve into real material.
Absolutely. Our policy here is we will talk about anything and everything that happened on these shows, so, which means you will be horribly spoiled if you haven't seen them. But it's been a week or so we certainly hope you have.
We have no remorse if we spoil you, so go back, watch them, play us again.
That's right. And let's see. As usual, I want to give an opportunity to everyone on the show to come up with their own priorities here. So, Gary... where do you want to start?
I will avoid some of the obvious, and I'll go to my teaser, which I wanted to talk about, Almost Human. I really am enjoying the show. It's getting better. I was a little concerned, but it's coming around for me.
Okay, well, why don't we go ahead and run the promo, and then we can jump in a little bit.
Someone want to tell me what I'm missing?
This is Dr. Nigel Vaughn. He created me.
In 3 weeks, Almost Human returns with all new episodes.
Who wants to see what happens to bad guys?
John, I don't think that's a good...
Blew his arm, clean off.
Yeah.
Let's go.
You're telling me to walk up to a homicidal robot and stab it in the back of the neck?
Uh-huh.
Great.
Almost Human returns Monday, January 6th on Fox.
Okay, and why don't you go ahead and give us the recap and get us started.
Absolutely. We're talking about Almost Human, Season 1, Episode 7. Simon says, a serial killer uses the web to broadcast his victims' final moments after strapping bombs to their necks, and Kennex is in danger of being added to the list of fatalities. Meanwhile, Dorian's energy level is affected by a power deficiency that causes unexpected outbursts. I like this in a few different ways. I'll start off with the sort of less dramatic. We get to see some of... Dorian's technical glitches, and we've heard this related to us in a variety of sort of snide offhand comments and why this series was pulled from being used on a daily basis. And you never quite had a sense of what went wrong, but I think this sort of gives us a little bit of insight into how their personality matrices can be distorted and affected, not so much as they turn into pathological murderers, but just there's glitches and it's not quite right and they have emotional outbursts. And I thought it was a nice way to sort of handle that situation, even if using power shortages was, I thought, a bit of a cop-out. As they started to talk about solar flares being the issue, I would have rather had that been the issue than just, we can't plug him in right now. But I thought it was a cute little plot device, and it definitely makes him seem a little bit more fallible. Sometimes he seems to know everything and has, you know, such strength and uncanny foresight. Sometimes when it comes to solving a problem, you almost want to, you know, you don't want to see any flaws in them. And it gives us a chance to see that Dorian, well, maybe not human, isn't perfect either. So I like that whole little B plot to the story, I guess you'd call it. And then the A plot, it's not quite brand new in the lines of the way plots go, it was still brought a lot of dramatic tension, I thought, to the show with these putting these collars around these people and giving them tasks, whether it's to rob a bank or to go and, I think, dance in the middle of a square was one of them. And but basically, the guy's just doing it to, I guess, get, you know, personal fame or notoriety, which I guess people do, of course, even this day, although not to that extreme. It was still a very sobering thing that the guy had such a lack of life that he just basically picks somebody out of nowhere and slaps these collars on him. And then we see Kennex and Dorian both manage to outsmart the guy, which I thought was fun. You know, once was a simple, you know, almost standard wire cutting bomb scene. And then the other one was, you know, it did start to get a little bit more imaginative along the way. So I overall, it was great. I wouldn't call it extremely deep, and it was a little tropey at times. I've seen some of these, you know, similar plots before, but it was still came together in a really entertaining package for me.
Yeah, it was fairly interesting within the context of Almost Human, but this was the episode that I was talking about when I made the wrong reference. Sorry, folks. I meant the movie Untraceable. It's maybe a good thing that I forgot the title, because it took me a moment to look it up and remember just how bad the movie was. This was a movie from about 5-6 years ago, and it had Diane Lane in it, and it was essentially this episode of Almost Human to a T. At least the antagonist. It was about a serial killer who rigs contraptions that kills victims based on the number of hits received by a website that features live streaming video of the victim. Only in the case of the movie, there were literally millions of people that were logging on. Here, it was a mere thousand. And you so have. The whole time I'm watching the show, I'm sitting there saying to myself, so this guy is, like, really, really excited over the adulation of the literally just the few people that bothered to get like on his stream, and it,
well, I think he got up to maybe 5,000 at the end there. But yeah,
maybe,
I agree.
But you'd think that notoriety would actually do something. I think he had less during the later parts of the episode than he did the first one. But it just seems so small scale to me. And a little bit predictable. I think that in Henry's review, he mentioned it almost had that classical three act structure to it. Of you knew exactly what was going to happen as it went along, and that bothered me a little bit. It made it hard for me to kind of get out of that overly familiar mode. So I don't know. It's again, what gets me on this show and what keeps me coming back is the Kennex Dorian relationship and how well that's being put together. Even though at this point I swear the writers are doing this on purpose, of having that talk in the car. And early in the first
I wasn't conscious of it until you talked about it a few shows ago, and now it blares out like a beacon every time it comes loud. It's like, hey, but yeah, it's but yeah, I'll geez, you know, it might be a little bit of a guilty pleasure, but you know, it's still a fun thing, and once you catch on that they're doing it for a guilty pleasure, it becomes even more funny. So I don't have that much of an issue with it.
Yeah, no, certainly it is one of the highlights of each episode. But yeah, I think I'm more in agreement with John in terms of enjoying the Kennex and Dorian stuff, and especially it seems like I'm feeling like there's something going on with the way they're handling Dorian that's akin to what they did with Spock in the original Trek, where the cliche about Spock is, oh, he's so, you know, he's so logical, et cetera, et cetera. No, he was half human, so he kept having, you know, he'd have these, you know, this emotional side to him, and they had Leonard Nimoy playing him, so they kept coming up with, you know, different scenarios where he'd get hit by spores or whatever, you know, and then start, you know, having to, you know, really act even more and act more and more human. And I feel like the same thing's going on here, where they've got Michael Ealy, who does this fabulous job. In this case, I mean, yes, they have he's a robot who's supposed to have emotions anyway, but then between the episode with the two of him, and now with this episode, it's like, you know, no, I can see where they're definitely, you know, looking to find situations where it's like, no, we can really let Michael Ealy loose in this episode. So which certainly is very entertaining. And I did love this whole idea of, you know, yeah, one of those things the designers probably didn't consider, that, you know, yes, you give them this personality matrix and then it gets a low battery and things fritz out a little bit, which could have these unexpected consequences. One of the problems with this sort of bomb scenario is, especially when you get both main characters there working on it, you kind of know that they're not really in danger. Thankfully, I've never seen that movie you mentioned, John, but what I was actually getting a funny vibe from was actually going back to the old Max Headroom series with, you know, these sort of huge proliferation of channels and streams and, you know, and people logging on, you know, and just, you know, these little small communities, and I was actually getting a little sense of that from our intrepid, if not really that popular, serial killer. And also certainly, I mean, that seemed to be part of the point, especially once they realized that, oh no, this was this hot girl who dumped you, and no wonder she dumped you. And, you know, everybody jumping off the stream because they just think they're just starting to realize this is silly. So, you know, I think there may have been some attempt at a little bit of future social commentary there, but yeah, it was not the strongest part of the episode, and that main duo still remains the heart of the show. And I again I'm feeling like there is more of the future world that they could be bringing in, and I hope they do once they feel they've really established the central stuff.
Gary, anything more?
Oh, well, no, I see your point, and I'll admit it. Yeah, as I said in my earlier discussion, it was a bit tropey, and I could see where they were pulling some standard things from. But yeah, I guess it's sort of what you were talking about, John, where the Kennex and Dorian work so well together that even running through what would be a stock plot is still enjoyable with these personalities.
Hmm. Yeah, the problem I see and continue to see is that, and once again, I'm not exactly sure exactly where this fit into the production order. That would be an interesting question to have answered, and I'll look that up as I'm talking. But as far as I'm concerned, they've done so much good work getting Dorian and Kennex down as characters that it's making it all the more obvious that the other supporting characters are less and less relevant because they're like cardboard copies. Or,
I know. Who's the girl? I always blank out on her name, but as they're the captain's asking her about all this technical stuff. Oh well, we can't figure it out. I was like, what an incompetent tech person. Well, I'm clicking the button and it's not I can't quite track the. it just struck me as they were desperately trying to come up with a way to give her some type of dialogue.
This was actually the 10th episode in production, so that's somewhat surprising to me. But once again, they're pulling a later episode up into an earlier slot. And actually, next week is episode 102.
102?
102.
Jeez.
I'd lost track of the shifting around. I thought we'd had two.
No. It's still shifting around like crazy. And we have yet to actually have, as I'm looking over the list here, 104 is still out there somewhere.
There's certainly, as far as the supporting cast goes, if this was 10, then they really hadn't been doing anything to
right. Exactly.
Build them. We have the other detective who's the hard ass and gives Dory a hard time, and especially with Stahl, after they drop those little feelers of her being the love interest, or at least them watching a game together, and she is still has. I mean, we essentially have no background on her at this point. At least have a little bit on Lily Taylor, on the lieutenant, but just the fact that I'm sitting here, I'm just giving them generic names because I can generic characters because I can't remember the names. It's not a good sign.
Exactly. I mean, until you mentioned that her name was Stahl, I forgot again.
Yeah,
I remember her as Minka Kelly. That's about. It's like the one played by her. So, yeah, let's see. I don't want to dwell too much on the things that aren't going well. I mean, it was a perfectly acceptable episode. I enjoyed it. I liked watching it, but for me, it also had the problem of, like I said, for better or worse, it was an all-too-familiar plot device, almost entirely a device. And so for me, that kind of took a little bit away from it because it was reminding me of something unfortunately I remembered but didn't quite enjoy, which doesn't help, and it was kind of an inferior way of doing it, which was kind of odd in my book. But at any rate, Henry gave this one a 6 out of 10. He was probably even less enamored of it than I was, because I would give it a 7. How about you, Edmund?
I think I would I would stick with the average 7 as well. It's one of those cases of if it was based just on the plot and what they're having to solve, it might stick lower, but at least for basically it's Michael Elias Dorian who's keeping it at a 7 right now.
And Gary?
Yeah, that's exactly where I was with it too. I was at a 7. I thought it was good, not great, but it was fair. Yeah.
Well, represents a good point drop from our thoughts on the last episode, Arrhythmia. So, I mean, that tells you right there that even though this was a fairly average episode for the most part for us, it still wasn't anywhere near where the show had been trending. It was a step backward. So hopefully they'll get back on track, but I am a little bit worried that I was hoping to look it up and see that it was episode 2 or 3 and to find that it was number 10 and it was actually the most recently produced out of all the episodes we've seen. That's discouraging, but you never know. This show literally has been so out of order. I don't even know where to begin.
Just as a side note, I know someone, and I don't know how they have access to it, but they have access to several episodes from this, you know, past this point. And they say it does ramp up, so okay. My fingers are crossed tonight. So,
all right, well, we'll see. I guess what will be interesting to me is when you know the time comes that the whole first season is out. I would actually like to see it in the order that was intended, and see if it's better that way. But you know, it's something that is fairly typical with Fox. All right, well, let's see. Let's go ahead then and move on to the next topic. And Edmund, you get to choose this time.
Okay, well, I will shock everybody by wanting to talk about the latest person of interest.
No, never.
I wouldn't have expected that.
It was a shocking revelation.
There was a second machine.
CBS Tuesday. On the first new person of interest of the year.
Where is the machine?
You think you're in charge?
It's adorable just how wrong you are.
Whoever controls the machines
is alive.
We will expose the abuses our government has perpetrated.
Controls everything.
They will use it to enslave others.
We're delaying the inevitable.
Cover your ears.
A new person of interest. CBS Tuesday, 10, 9 central.
All right, and Edmund, if you go ahead and just do the recap, because we'll try and keep this from being a monologue if we can.
Okay. This is Person of Interest, Season 3, Episode 12, Aletheia. The team faces threats from multiple enemies as they protect a dying man, but the absence of Reese hinders their efforts and puts them all in danger.
Yes, or as I would probably term it, the mid-season reshuffling of the status quo for Person of Interest.
Again.
Talk about an extended fallout or aftermath from the HR saga. The really interesting thing that I see coming out of all of this is that not only is Person of Interest just absolutely killing it this season, literally, but that they're almost taking an approach that is similar to the way that, say, some comic books do things, where it's in little chunks of story arcs. You know, we had a 3-parter, and now we have ostensibly a 2-parter right after it. And, you know, I'm sure that we'll have the occasional one-shot episode, but it seems like what they're doing is they're playing with this whole idea of what is traditional in terms of how to do a show like this. And it's really interesting. It's kind of keeping the audience on their toes, because this is one of those shows where I really have no idea where it's going to go next. And I like that. There's so much that happened in this episode that was against my expectation. But go ahead, I'll let you jump in with the. I know that you're going to be gushing, so.
I certainly agree with all of that. As I'd already mentioned in the email, I mean, you'd already picked up on this whole thing. I like your analogy more of it being like the comic book format. Doing these limited runs and bringing it to a head, and then starting up this new thing. But certainly the biggest shocker here was after they done this whole setup of bringing Cameron Manheim, introducing her as Control, having this you know, and as opposed to the previous HR arc where it was like these three stories that kind of hung together on their own, even though they were connected, of doing a straight cliffhanger, coming right back into the cliffhanger, and having Root come in and rescue them, which was really the only thing that could happen, unless Reese and Fusco had magically made it from Colorado, which they still kind of did at the end, but I'll give them a little leeway there. We're not exactly sure when they left that cell. But to go through all of that and have, yes, Root come in, Root rescue them, but then have them get split up again, and Root basically sacrificing herself to let them get away, which I really felt was the example of how the machines that are retasking has really been taking hold. So once again, we're not only getting down two people, but they're split up and Root in the clutches of the enemy, and Finch and Sean and Arthur have to go off on their own. And luckily, I did like the thing that Arthur wasn't quite as out of it as he'd been trying to make everybody believe, but still somewhat. So that certainly helped a little bit. But
If you don't mind.
Okay, yeah, I mean, I'm not. No, absolutely.
Yeah, you were talking about Root, and that was a big shock to me. I almost wanted to dock a little bit off because I was so loving having her playing Finch so well, you know, being the dutiful little prisoner when in reality she's more connected than any of them are in that little cage. But having her kind of go off, I suppose, is more of a consideration of freeing up the narrative a little bit more. But Root in this episode was amazing. And not just that, but if we thought that her description of the machine before was creepy, I think it got amped up about to 11 in this episode, because to hear how the machine thinks of the team is really interesting. It was kind of giving me those Destination Void vibes again. But it also was making me wonder, okay, now we know that there's two out there, at least the potential for a second one out there. And it's like, okay, we know what the apparently benevolent one is like. But I could see this going so wrong in so many ways if it decided that protecting humanity from itself was no longer a good idea. And I don't know if Root's stuff in this episode was supposed to be a hint along the lines of, like, oh yeah, if you think we've touched on how this could be abused or it could turn into a nightmare situation already, you haven't seen anything yet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the thing that really scared me was those hints that were dropped through these episodes that yes, the Samaritan, the version Saul Rubinex was working on, was intended to be the version that didn't have the restrictions that Harold put on his, but it was more open access and able to more specifically target, and the implications of all of that, especially with it in fact not falling into the government's hands, as scary as Control and Hirsch and all of that group are, but falling into Decima's hands and Greer getting it in the end, is really setting things up for I normally would say for the second half of the season, but the way they're churning through story, who knows, that might just be for the next three episodes. But I think at this point, yes, this is the reset for the second half of the season. And I was speculating about this to myself about, okay, was it just that Cameron Manheim is only available for a little while, or no? It was they knew, and I think it was probably more the fact that no, they knew they were going this way, this direction. So, yes, we just need you to come in for these few episodes to let us make this turn, and everybody thinks you're going to be the big bad, and then we're going to go off in this other direction. And obviously she's still in the picture, but I assume we'll be more in the background and just maybe making an occasional appearance, perhaps as things ramp up towards the end of the season. But they have just really turned on its head, and I do just have to make special mention of that torture scene between Amy Acker and Cameron Manheim was one of the most weirdly scary things I have ever seen. There's for example, some of the older listeners out there may remember, or maybe you've caught it on video, that that little film called Marathon Man with Dustin Hoffman and Laurence Olivier, which kind of defined nasty torture scenes for a certain generation. And Control, digging the stirrup out of Root's ear, was right up there. And but then to have it turn so quickly, and especially in that that way that I knew when it got mentioned, and the little device of Control bringing the phone in but not letting her have it, and then the machine sending out Morse code at that very high frequency that people over 40 can't hear, but Root, of course, could, to let her know exactly what she needed to do. And the fact that the production team actually did put it on the soundtrack of the episode, so that the younger viewers who could actually hear it did actually translate it and put it on the internet, so I could find out what the machine actually said.
And what did the machine say? Yeah, not,
it, it was very, very, very straightforward, but the most intriguing in terms of the, you know, the data it was giving out, mentioning the knee operation on one of the guards, telling what was, but the first thing it did was it did say sorry.
Oh.
it apologized to her.
Oh, there you go.
Having gotten her into that situation, but if anything, that was sort of the scariest part. That yes, okay, it really is sentient at this point, and has its attachments. But we did also kind of know that already in terms of the ways it protected Harold in those very early days, and also the flashbacks we've been getting in terms of the very early genesis of the machine and him trying to build something to protect his father, you know, to preserve his father's memories. I really do wonder how that might be playing into the psyche of it now that it's finally achieved its sentience. In terms of it being built as not something that was a bit of a protector, and I don't really have, especially with the way this writing staff has been going, I don't really want to speculate too much, because I really just want to see where they're going with it, and especially now with this setup of another machine that may not be quite so circumspect, as scary as the machine's own development has been. Now that Samaritan may be out there, and it's going to be a very, very interesting question of whether it's a good Samaritan or a bad Samaritan, and, especially given whose hands it's in. So, some very intriguing stuff, and what's really amazing me is how well now the machinery of the show has developed, where they can do all of this excellent action stuff in terms of the standoff at the bank and Vigilance holding off Hirsch, giving Shaw a believable way of sort of wedging between them to effect this escape. So even though it seems like a situation that there's no way they can get out of, having that sort of Mexican standoff between Vigilance and Hirsch upstairs, giving them a way to get out of there, and at the same time incorporating these pretty intense scenes with Fusco and Reese in the jail cell, and Reese really, really letting you know just how dark a place he's gotten to, where he just doesn't feel they're doing any good, and since he's now lost two of his closest people, and while they may be doing some good in the present, it's just delaying the inevitable, and then the scene between Finch and Arthur in the vault when he believes convincing him to destroy the drives, and it certainly helps when you have Michael Emerson and Saul Rubinek there to just take the scene about what it means to create a child in computer form, basically, and convince somebody to kill it. But just managing to have all of those pieces and just meld them together so beautifully, and then have another of those episodes where you've gotten to the end and you think, oh, great, they got out of it, it's destroyed, and the team's back together, and then it's like, no, sorry, guys, 5 minutes left in the episode. Reese is going to walk out. The drives are perfectly safe, except they're in the hands of Greer. Now we're ready to just spiral off into the rest of the season, and yes, we have no idea what's going to happen, and that's what we love about this show, because they put us in these situations, and then just take us to places that are just as good.
Yeah, I was really expecting Reese to kind of, by the end of this episode, come back into the fold, and the fact that it's not that simple is a really nice touch. I'm curious as to how the machine is going to deal with that, because it seemed fairly obvious that the implication was that the machine wants him back. So, you know, how is the machine going to deal with this kind of intransigence on his part? It's like, is the machine going to maneuver events to push him into it or what? Cause it's done things like that before. So it is going to be interesting, but you gave this a 10.
I wrestled with it a bit. I mean, once I finished watching it, I knew I was giving it at least a 9, and then had one of those situations where, especially rewatching certain scenes as I was writing the review, I really couldn't see any reason to take a point off. I mean, this was a pretty stunning conclusion to this little two-parter, and in a way to this whole 5-episode arc. And so I gave it a 10.
Yeah, I'm not quite at a 10. Maybe I'll kind of, with my 9, represent a little bit of where you were wrestling with it, so that this fits rather comfortably in between. I don't want to take too much away from it, because it was still a very good episode, and definitely introduced a lot of curves that I wasn't expecting. But again, I don't know, maybe it was just the uncertainty of what was going on, and it felt like this was still transitional to some degree. And it's going to depend a little bit on where it goes from here as to how this fits as a that transitional piece. So still, that's, you know, between exceptional and top flight. So yeah, it's not really that much of a distinction at this point. Let's see then. Well, we are just about at the right time for a mid-show break, so we're going to go ahead and take that, and we'll be right back. So stay tuned. All right, and now that we're back, Gary, I know that you had a little bit of a break there. You were able to take some time to think about what you were going to choose next, and what are we going to talk about now?
I would like to talk about Elementary.
Okay. Let's go
again,
ahead.
Wow, then. I'm just perpetually happy about some of the shows that I get to watch and talk about on this, on our podcast, because they're really enjoyable for me, and it's hard to carve out TV time for me sometimes. But they're actually two episodes since we've last talked about this show.
Yep, and let's go ahead and run the promo for the first one.
Sure.
Love is a game I fail to understand.
New year, new elementary, CBS Thursday.
Oh, we're the crooked kind.
The world's corruption runs deeper than even you know.
The mind games are just beginning.
Woman is a riddle wrapped in a mystery inside an enigma I have had sex with.
You still have feelings for her?
In the first elementary of the new year. New Thursday.
You look a bit tired.
You look a bit evil.
Sherlock's greatest rival returns.
Okay, and why don't you go ahead with that recap, Gary?
Absolutely. We're talking about Elementary, Season 2, Episode 12, The Diabolical Kind. Holmes and Watson face their one-time adversary, Moriarty, when she is brought in as a consultant on a kidnapping case. Meanwhile, Belt continues to struggle with his recovery. I have to say, while I'm enjoying this series, this one didn't quite hit the mark for me. It seemed a little hollow, and I know it shouldn't. You know, we've talked about how much we enjoy, the Moriarty character and what a good foil she is, not only for Holmes but even for Watson to some extent. And it felt like they pranced her out just to have her on the show, and it didn't work for me. I realize we got that little buildup of seeing where she was, being kept, even though we didn't know she was being kept where she was. And, there were some cutesy things like the painting of Watson and stuff like that. But it just, I didn't feel the need for her. And I guess that's the problem. Usually they're so intricately entwined, she almost felt like an afterthought. And as we, as they got through with this, we first thought she was involved and she wasn't. And then it turned out she was again. And it didn't seem maybe what I was expecting. I expected her to be, I guess, even, she didn't feel like she was, behind everything as much as a Moriarty character typically is.
Yeah, I was similarly not enjoy this as much as I expected. It did feel a little forced, and I really did not like the twist of it, the kidnapped girl turning out to be her own daughter. At least they didn't go to the lengths of it being Holmes' daughter.
Mm. We or their daughter. Do that. Or their daughter.
That's what I'm saying. That it was definitely from her, but not by Holmes. But the age kind of gave that away. Mm. Similar to you, this idea of it being her lieutenants who are doing this, but but not her being completely behind it. And then it winding up being basically the mother protecting her daughter from her own people just didn't quite sit right. I mean, I actually did enjoy the interplay between her and Holmes and Watson, and taking advantage of the way they've shifted things in terms of the gender to have Moriarty trying to place these doubts in Watson's head about, yes, he's fascinated with you now, but once he's figured you out, he's just going to discard you. That felt like real Moriarty stuff to me. But the actual case itself wound up feeling a little trumped up, and as you said, just created just to bring her into the show. And I guess it's a matter of if they had done something that in a way was more not that there's this has any place in terms of taking any direct inspiration from the Holmes canon, but having a case come up where they feel they or the feds feel the need to bring Moriarty in, and then it's circling back to her despite all the restrictions, having found a way to engineer this, would have felt more in keeping. And so I feel like this was a bit of a wasted opportunity, that they could have done more with it. And as much as I enjoyed Natalie Dormer playing the character, and the way the interactions with the three main characters came off, and even the and yes, I should have the cast at my fingertips, but I don't. But having the regent from Warehouse 13 as her federal keeper, I did like the dynamic there. So there was a lot of the setup that I enjoyed, but the case itself just wound up not working for me in the context.
I didn't feel that it needed to be Moriarty, and that, you know, it usually is, you know, such a focus centered issue that Moriarty becomes an invaluable character, and I didn't feel that was the case.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Hmm.
Yeah, I'd agree with that.
So Bronstam obviously liked this a lot more. I mean, he gave this one I think he gave it a 9 out of 10. He thought it was a really good episode. So what would you give it, Edmund?
I would still give it an 8, despite all the things I've said. I mean, it was more the case itself that was bringing it down for me, and I think some of the setup with where Moriarty is and the relatively nice accommodations she's negotiated for herself, and then especially the interplay with Watson, I did enjoy a lot, and that kept it above average for me. And if the central kidnapping had been better, it would have been higher than that. But I would still give it the 8.
Okay, and Gary.
Geez, I'm sorry. Just having Moriarty, you know, flash her smile isn't going to be enough for me. I dropped it to a 6. I thought it was an average episode, and it probably would have been lower if she wasn't in it. But it was a poor story. It really was. It was not good. And while yes, the Watson Moriarty interaction was nice, that was probably about it for this episode. And I can't bring it more than a 6 for what it presented. The next episode, on the other hand, is the one I'd like to talk about.
Okay, well, let's go ahead and run the promo, and then we can jump into it.
Next Thursday.
I suppose we could announce our arrival.
What's in this leg?
Most prostheses don't have a hidden compartment.
And what's in this freezer?
Should I be afraid?
Or nothing.
Think I got something here.
Compared to what's in this barrel. A New Elementary, next Thursday.
Next. Okay, Gary, go for it.
Oh, absolutely. We're talking about Season 2, Episode 13, All in the Family. A body is found in a barrel, and the investigation leads Holmes and Watson to look into the Mafia's ties to the murder. Meanwhile, Sherlock tries to make amends with Detective Bell. This episode hit in every way that I could possibly imagine this episode could hit. I can't imagine really a better one. Admittedly, the story or the murder wasn't the prime focus of this episode, but it didn't need to, because this was really, it was a character piece that we got to see all the, you know, the characters' relations, primarily Sherlock's with Lieutenant Bell. They're dancing around to have them sort of come to terms with what happened and move forward, as well as Holmes actually, you know, admitting a respect and a peerage with Lieutenant Bell was, in some ways, both humbling for Holmes, and he sort of, you know, opened up a little bit. And I think it was surprising to Lieutenant Bell as well, because he didn't, you know, I don't think he expected Holmes to ever try and, in his own way, sort of apologize or at least come to terms with him over what had happened. I thought it was so. That was the shining part of this episode. And the as they were talking about the Mafia, they pulled in so many old Mafia guy actors. It was almost a checklist. I can't count the many times that I've seen these guys either killed or killing other people in different mafia type stories. So it was really a nice little homage to pull out all the different actors that they did to play the different crime lords or former maid guys that went on. Holmes' interaction with Lieutenant Bell's superior that we later found out, you know, there were issues with, was I thought really well handled, and it sort of shows how Holmes sort of works his way into a place, and it was fun. Did you guys like this episode as much as I did? Because I thought it was great.
I did enjoy it. I don't think I enjoyed it quite as much as you, I certainly agree that the real heart of the episode was finally working through. I shouldn't say finally. It's only been a few episodes, but working through the tension with Detective Bell, and I think the one the One thing that that kind of got to me was that there was so much focus on that that it wound up being a case where, as far as I could tell, you didn't really need a Sherlock to solve it. Or perhaps that was the point. That it was Bell who they tipped off to the possibility, and he was resisting it, and then is the one who basically gets the goods.
That's exactly the point. In a way, Holmes gave up the glory or the satisfaction of solving it himself to give it to Bell to let him do it. I thought that was, I don't want to call it self-sacrificing, because Bell's a lieutenant too, and he's equally charged with trying to find these things out. And even as Holmes point out, he has an instinct for this type of thing. But it's obvious that Holmes sort of dropped it in his lap and let him, benefit from it. And it was that type of thing where we always had a sense, especially Bell is like, was talking to Holmes how he likes to be the center of attention and figure these things out and think he's better than everybody else. But in this sense, he shows Sherlock giving up this case in a sense to let Bell do that, because Sherlock doesn't need to win every case.
Mm-hmm.
And they made that point beginning of the episode when he wouldn't work well with the other detectives, because once he discovered it, he wouldn't give it up. So it was sort of a development as well, throughout this episode, is showing how he realizes he needs to.
Yeah, that is actually, I think, I certainly take that point, and I think that is one of the intriguing directions they're going with this version of it. This idea of really running with Holmes being a recovering addict and delving into those things, such as giving credit to people and making amends and not having your life revolve around yourself the way Sherlock does in virtually every other incarnation.
Well, what did you think about that scene in the hallway when he's talking about the whole drug addict thing?
Oh, exactly. No, that's what I was just thinking about, was the fact that I thought Johnny Lee Miller just absolutely killed it in that scene, where he was still completely in character as Holmes, where he's being very forceful, but what he's saying is really working to inspire Bell and let him know that I believe in you, I have faith in you, you say you've got a tremor and you may or may not ever be able to be a detective or be out on the street, but I have faith that you can do it, so go out there and do it. Certainly something that you don't normally expect to see a Sherlock Holmes character saying. I will certainly give them credit for the tack they are taking with it, and I guess the more we talk about it, just I'm willing to give them a pass on the fact that it's not a twisty turdy Sherlock Holmes mystery, but
I thought it was a bit of a twist. You went from the body being the body being murdered by guy one, and then it traces all the way back to the commissioner for a whole sort of different reason, and I thought that was a warranted twist, and it may not be over the top crazy, but I thought it was the genuinely good one.
Yeah, no, it was a twist, but it felt to me like the actual detective work was more, to a large extent, standard shoe leather detective work.
That's why he let Bell do it. he's going to give him.
But it was also and I'm realizing sort of as we talk about it, some of my reservations I'm letting fall away a bit, because it wasn't just Bell, it was also the fact that this was another case where Watson gets to make major contributions to, since it as it happens she was growing up around all this mafia talk, etc. So she does actually know all of this back history, and she's the one who's actually doing a lot of the digging through the files and finding the connections I think that's also one of those cases of one of those things that the standard Holmes character would consider those irrelevant things that he doesn't need to necessarily keep track of. Although at the same time, I think the classic Holmes, yes, would absolutely know all of the crime families of New York.
I had a spare weekend, so I familiarized myself with them.
Yes. but yeah, this was a nice episode in terms of turning the focus more on those secondary characters, and actually, certainly, I mean, in terms of what we were talking about with Almost Human, I mean, this, Elementary is the show where absolutely that more secondary cast and supporting cast has been given the room to grow and get their background fleshed out and give us characters who we really know something about and care about, and you know, yeah, just like Holmes, we want to see Bell have some faith in himself and manage to overcome all this and get back to being the detective he is. So yeah. After starting out saying I think I probably am still maybe a little less positive about this one than you were, but you're bringing me around.
I'm glad I could persuade you.
So what would you give it, Edmund?
I was at a 7, but I will now go up to an 8.
Ooh, and Gary?
I'm going to give it a 9. It was just that, as I said, you know, for this to be a 10, in my mind, it does have to be a little bit more Holmes-focused, or at least Holmes and Watson-focused, and this wasn't. Not that it's a bad thing, but, it, you know, given what who the show stars are, I guess it does have to be that to be a 10, but it's definitely a strong 9.
Okay. Sounds good to me. And I think that this is a good place for us to wrap up this particular show. Next time, we are going to be jumping into the most recent episode of Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. and then some of our quick hits, and who knows what else beyond that. So, till next time. Thank you, gentlemen, for all your help for this episode. And definitely, if you want to give us some comments, you can follow us on Twitter at Critical Myth, or you can go and like our page on Facebook. Again, that's Critical Myth.
You can give us feedback by visiting the website over at www.criticalmyth.com. Just check out the entries for the show and leave us a comment. If you can't find it, just go all the way up to the top of the page. There's a link there, and there's also a drop-down box for all of the shows we talk about. So please let us know what you think.
Or you can go over to the VOG Network page and go over to the forums, and we have a dedicated forum for the show. You can leave comments there for us.
You can also email your feedback to feedback@criticalmyth.com, or you can leave us a review on iTunes.
Or you can call our Google voicemail line at 908-977-MYTH. That's 908-977-6984.
And don't forget that Critical Myth's use of any and all copyright material is only intended for parody, news analysis, critique, or for educational purposes, as provided within United States Code Title 17, also known as the Fair Use Act. Please don't sue us.
And the comments and opinions of the Critical Myth podcasters and reviewers are not necessarily those of its distributors, partners, or affiliates. But let's face it, we're probably right anyway. So until next time...